Hi, I'm Dan Hornberger, the host of Breaking Chains, the podcast that focuses on the grassroots of disc golf, the amateurs, the local clubs, the individuals who make a difference, and those who have had their lives changed because of the sport. A professional disc golf course designer, promoter, and player, J. Gary Droptroe has been active in the sport since 1980. He's been a major force behind the disc golf scene in Western Pennsylvania, initiating and running disc golf tournaments and events at the scholastic, collegiate, and highest professional levels. He has also been a leader in local, regional, and national disc golf organizations. Droptroe has over 30 professional disc golf association titles and was elected to the Pennsylvania Disc Golf Hall of Fame in 2013 and the International Disc Golf Hall of Fame in 2015. Pay attention, listeners, because J. Gary holds a wealth of information. And this episode is part one of my interview with him. J. Gary Droptroe, my guest for this episode of Breaking Chains. All right, J. Gary, I know you lived quite a long time in the Pittsburgh area. Did you grow up out there?
I actually grew up in Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
It's a small college town.
Yep.
It's about 60 miles from Pittsburgh. Family lived there for a number of years. My dad taught at the university, and I graduated from IUP, Indiana University, Pennsylvania, in 1980. That's where I met Jan, my wife, and moved to Pittsburgh soon after graduating college. So I've been living in Pittsburgh for Pittsburgh area, I guess.
Well, you're in Wexford, correct?
Wexford is a northern suburb of Pittsburgh. Yeah, pretty close to Nob Hill Park, where that disc golf course is.
Okay, so you grew up in Indiana, Pennsylvania. Did you play sports when you were growing up?
I played Little League Baseball, tried out for high school teams, but kind of a late bloomer and really wasn't, just wasn't kind of big enough, strong enough, whatever, to really do well at those, just kind of intramural sports. Then at IUP, discovered Ultimate. Helped to form an Ultimate Frisbee club there.
Okay, so you started out with Ultimate. Okay.
Yeah, and remember reading an article in Time magazine about Ultimate and how they flew these Frisbees and played this field sport, and was intrigued with that. And we had, as kids, thrown Frisbees around in the yard. They weren't even Frisbees. They were CPI saucer tossers. And why I remember,
oh my gosh, I never heard of that.
Why I remember the name of that disc, I don't know exactly.
Was it a Whammo knockoff or what?
It wasn't even a Whammo knockoff. It was a flying disc. It flew pretty good. At one point, CPI made a pro model. And this is sort of after much later. What I'm describing, just throwing the Frisbee around in the backyard with my brothers, was maybe 10. 12, something like that. And you had to put a ton of hyzer on these discs to throw a backhand shot. And if you threw it, you had to throw it real gently. But if you got it right, if you just kind of with the right weight on the throw and kind of lofted it out there, it would flip up and just kind of hover and then drift real slowly to the right. And maybe if it was just perfect day, it might just fade back. And so I was intrigued by seeing them fly like that. The first Frisbee I saw was at a family picnic, and I was even younger. I might have been 5 or something. I just remember my aunt saying, "Oh, look at this new toy we just found. It's called a Frisbee." And she pulled this thing out and started flipping it around. And yeah, I thought it was cool. And so in high school, when everybody else was going to prom, and it was me and a couple other buddies, we would just fly a Whammo, like a 100, I guess like a 40 mold or something that had just come out recently. And we were just go in the parking lot at the high school and just throw Frisbees until 1 a.m. Under the light.
And you saved yourself a lot of money.
Yeah, I did. So I don't know. I've just sort of always been enthralled with the flight of them.
So you start playing in Ultimate leagues in college?
Yeah, no, there was an ad in the student newspaper, the Penn, the Indiana Penn, about come to a meeting to form an Ultimate Frisbee team. So I went to the meeting, And there were like five other, you know, guys there. And one of them, his brother, one of them was his name was Mike Powers. Mike went to IUP, and Mike sort of was the catalyst at getting this team together. Me and Mike and a couple other guys, I don't remember all the guys' name. There was Scotty and Joe Adams, and I can't remember the other all the other players, but we were terrible. So we got our team together. We got, you know, sanctioning or recognition from the university as a club. And that was cool because they offered to let us take out one of their vans to travel to tournaments. So we, you know, we kind of got a ragtag squad together. We might have had, you know, we might have had 8-9 players maybe. And the first tournament we went to was at Lock Haven University. And at that time, this would have been in like 1978, Penn State was like master of the world. They were the national ultimate champions, and they were just, you know, the best. Ultimate was a lot different then. I mean, there wasn't a club scene. It was sort of college, sort of club. It was a mix of things. But anyway, went to this tournament at Lock Haven, and we lost every game. The game against Penn State, we didn't score one goal. We went to other tournaments like that, kind of collegiate tournaments around Pennsylvania. We went to a tournament at Bucknell, stayed overnight at one of the Bucknell players' house, slept under their kitchen table on the floor and sleeping bags. And, you know, we were loving it and really was, you know, just welcomed by other Frisbee players. They wanted to see other people play the game and enjoyed it so much. So they were, you know, willing to talk about what they were doing and how they did it. And yeah, so it was a great experience and a good, a big opening for me. I helped to found a club team in Pittsburgh where it was called Steel City Slag, and recruited a number of Pitt players to play on it. But there were some CMU players as well. Henry Thorne was one of the people that kind of came on board with that. Henry's he's a legend in Pittsburgh with Ultimate. He really helped to found the community for Pittsburgh Ultimate, and his sons are, he's got a couple of sons that are world-class Ultimate players as well. Anyway, Henry played on the team, and a number of other people. We kind of got an Ultimate scene going in Pittsburgh. And got a club team going, traveled around. We would go to Virginia and Delaware, New Jersey and Pennsylvania and play in tournaments, weekend kind of things. And that was a great experience too. Pretty much my Ultimate career ended at a tournament in DC. I think it might even have been an April Fool's tournament, but I tore my ACL. That was pretty much it. I did have it reconstructed, but at that point it just didn't. And it came back and played a little bit more after that, but it just didn't seem like it was worth it.
And back then, the repair on the ACL was not nearly as good as it is now.
No way. Yeah. So I just, yeah, I knew about disc golf and sort of transitioned into playing that.
Do you remember what year that was?
Well, my dad taught at the university. It was, as I told you. So one of the great benefits of that was I didn't pay tuition to the state university. So coming on 4 years, I wasn't real sure what I was going to do. And I just decided to do a fifth year. And in between those years, and this was in 1979, my buddy Joe Adams, who was on the Ultimate Frisbee team at IUP, said, "Hey, I heard about this thing. It's called Discovering the World. And this guy named Ron Kaufman is organizing this trip to Europe to play Frisbee. Let's go."
Yes.
I said, yes. I took out a student loan, which in fact paid for that summer of Frisbee in Europe. And I went on the International Friendship Tour, is what it was called, with Joe and Ron Kaufman. Tita Ugalde, Charlie Callahan were on this trip. Tita Ugalde's from they're both from California. They're both in the Disc Golf Hall of Fame now. Carrie Colmar and Carl Mountain Crone from New York City were on the tour. Cary Colmar was the inventor of the nail delay, which is a freestyle trick where you spin the disc on your fingernail, and you can use your nail under the rim to do all kind of tricks with the disc. And Harvey Brandt was also on the trip. Harvey's from Phoenix area, incredible overall player, and Ron Kaufman. And we flew over to London, and that's where we met the rest of the group. We stayed in London for, I guess, about a week. There was a first European and seventh UK National Frisbee Disc Championships. And it included, it was an overall tournament. And they had freestyle, they had discathon, they had like a demonstration exhibition sports of ultimate and disc golf.
What was the venue?
And it was at Richmond Athletic Grounds. I don't know exactly where that is, but it was in London. And there were champions from Belgium and France and Germany, the UK that were there taking part. The world, at that time, the women's world frisbee freestyle champion, Laura Engel, and her partner, freestyle partner, Jim Emerson, were there to do a demonstration. It was amazing. I'd never freestyled before. I was all about ultimate, right? And I just couldn't wait to play ultimate. For me, the big thing was, okay, the ultimate demo, we're going to play the ultimate demo. But meanwhile, there are all these other things going on. So Joe and I said, okay, we'll be freestyle partners and we'll do this freestyle routine in front of these people. We'll be totally embarrassed, but what the heck? We flopped around a little bit and threw back and forth and jumped and caught them between our legs. And, you know, anyway, we had fun with that and watched, you know, the top freestylers, and we're just blown away by what they were doing. And then we played in this ultimate demonstration, and it was a lot of fun. We were running around and, you know, we're playing with other ultimate players who knew how to play. And by this time we'd both kind of developed a forehand, be able to throw a flick as well as backhand. And, you know, we knew the game, knew how to play, and that was really good. So from there we went to France and we did this demonstration at a place called Cyclocampus, and it was just a big sports venue. There were fields, big pitches, and I think they had like an amusement park there too. And we put out a frisbee demonstration for the people that were in the park that day, and that was cool. We went to Amsterdam.
Oh my gosh, what a great opportunity.
I know, this is an incredible trip of a lifetime, really. There wasn't anything really organized there, but, you know, we toured Amsterdam and we played some object disc golf in Vondel Park, this beautiful park with just manicured grounds and flower beds. And we just made up holes and played object golf. And I guess it was probably the first time I'd played. I wouldn't say it's the first time I played disc golf, because as kids, we would throw those CPI saucer tossers around the yard, at the tree, at the post on the deck, at the garbage can, those kind of, we'd make up holes and play disc golf like everybody else has done before there were baskets. And that's kind of where the trip ended in Belgium. We ended up in Belgium, and there was a European Ultimate Championship that were in Belgium, and there was going to be a team from USA in the tournament, and the main part of the team was coming from this trip. And so Ron Kaufman, who was an avid ultimate player, and myself, Joe Adams, and then there were a number of other players that just got put on this team somehow. One guy, real tall guy, I remember, name was Rick Lilly. We were the team. And the end of the story is that the USA team won the tournament, but because we weren't a European team, we weren't crowned the champions. But in any case, I cry foul
on that.
Well, yeah, whatever. I mean, we beat all the teams. That's kind of what mattered, I guess. But for me, the I don't know, this is like, it's not really my history, but it seemed to have happened to me more than once. But in any case, in this tournament, in the first game of the tournament, my buddy Joe Adams threw me a beautiful pass. I did catch this one. And I did score the goal, but I sprained my ankle on the catch. And so I was out for the tournament, and I had to watch the rest of my team kind of win every game. And it was exciting. And the, other players were from France and France and Belgium and Italy. They were great. I mean, many of them didn't speak English. Some of them did, but we, you know, we spoke Frisbee, and so we hung out together, and it was a big players party at Jacques Dutch's house, and he took us for a ride in his Citroen, and he went about 100 miles an hour down this road, and you know, it was a great experience. I ended up having to stay in Belgium. It was in Namur, and the tournament was actually held at this citadel. It was a sand field. There wasn't even grass. It was sand.
Ooh, that had to be tough.
Yeah, I had to stay there a couple extra weeks because I couldn't walk for a while. So I just hung out at this hostel. It was called Jacques Hostel, and it was actually an international frisbee sanctuary. At least that's what he claimed. And so I just hung out there with the other, you know, other people that were coming and going until I was well enough to walk and made my connections back to London and flew home.
And you had to go back to your fifth year of school.
And I did go back to my fifth year of school, but it was a pretty easy year. I think I took some photography courses and some couple writing courses. It wasn't even a full load, but yeah, it was great. It was a great experience. And that, as much as anything, just sort of propelled me into believing that, you know, this is my sport. And so I guess the every opportunity from that was just kind of building on that. So I came back to Pittsburgh and, you know, started this club ultimate team, but had torn my ACL. And so there's, I'm not going to be playing ultimate anymore, but some of the ultimate players that I met, including Steve Komen and Dave Bickerman, were into other disc sports as well. We're into freestyle and disc golf. So I started talking, hearing about other disc golf stuff going on. And Steve said, well, you know, there's this tournament in Rochester. Let's go to that. And we can play disc golf. And, you know, they play DDC, which I'd never played before. There's freestyle and all these things. And, you know, let's go. So we did. I hopped in Steve's car and went up for the weekend. And so there we see like John Kirkland freestyling and Stork Roddick playing DDC and Jim Palmieri, also an outstanding DDC player, and all these other, Jim Herrick, and all these other world champions playing the Frisbee games. And we're playing right with them. You know, we're getting beat badly at DDC, and I still can't freestyle very well. And we're throwing MTA, and we're throwing TRC, throw, run, and catch, and distance, and you know, doing all those things. But we're also playing disc golf, and they had a basket course set up at Genesee Park, and it's the first time I saw a pole hole, but they only had one or two of those. There were also these ground baskets that we were putting into, which were
ground baskets.
They were like just a chicken wire that was sort of formed into a, you know, like a cylinder, and it was about the diameter of a tray on a, you know, a pole hole or a regular basket.
Yeah.
But they were sitting on the ground.
How about that?
And they were about 2.5 feet deep. So you had to putt much differently to get them put in the basket. You know, a lot of hyzer, kind of almost vertical in some cases. But as I said, there were a couple of pole holes there. They were Mach 1s, single chain. And the trays were probably about 6 inches deep, but it was amazing. I think there was also a saucer hole there in addition to a pole hole. I don't know if you've ever seen a saucer hole,
no.
But it's got a basket, but it's sort of, the basket's sort of shaped like a cone. And then it's got the top of it is a cone also, but it's inverted. So the idea is to hit the cone, the top cone, and deflects the disc into the bottom cone.
So it drops in the bottom.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They had at least one of those saucer holes there too. And so you had all these different putting styles, you know, to be able to putt out, hit the chains. There was that with the pole hole. There was the saucer hole where you had to hit it and deflect it the right angle in. And then they had the ground baskets that you had to drop it into. But the, you know, it was golf. The holes were certainly, they were much shorter. We were throwing, some people were throwing lids. I think there were Midnight Flyers out at that point. It was Wham-O's golf disc, and they molded them. There were 40 molds and 70 molds, and they filled them with this phosphorescent plastic that glowed in the dark, and they were much heavier than, you know, like 119 gram or 140 gram frisbee that you'd buy at the, you know, at the sporting goods stores. These discs, the 70 molds, which were, you know, probably about the little bit bigger than a 24 centimeter disc, golf disc current, you know, like we currently throw, a little bit bigger in diameter, but smallish, but a deep rim to them. You know, they weren't beveled rims, but these discs would weigh like 150 grams or 140 grams. And they were heavier than the regular frisbee. And you could just throw them harder, you know, and they would hold the line. You still had to, you know, put the right angle on them, but they, I guess that's where I bought a bunch of those at this tournament and started throwing them in the event. Cause I was up there with, like you were saying, you know, an ultimate lid, a Whammo 80 mold or something. So it was, you know, instructive to see players throwing these things 100 yards or more.
Is this where you got the itch to?
Yeah. And it was, yeah, very inspiring. Steve Komen had played some tournaments in Florida where he went to school. And so he was definitely more advanced than I was. So he said, yeah, I'm going to go to this tournament, the Throw for the Roses down in Louisville, Kentucky. Let's go. So we went to that tournament. And that's where I met the Clarks, KB Clark and HB Clark and RB Clark, the famous Clark brothers from Louisville. KB's been a lifelong friend. He lives in Pittsburgh now. He moved here with his wife when he got a job, and he was one of the players that sort of jumped into our ultimate scene as well, and has been a real force at kind of moving the scene along in Pittsburgh for a number of years. And then I met Red Whittington, who had been playing frisbee as well, started in Florida, and he's from Pittsburgh and was a freestyler, and he threw boomerangs, but then he kind of discovered disc golf, and he and Steve Komen kind of developed this object course in Schenley Park where they would put tape on these trees and you'd hit the tree, but you had to hit the tree between the pieces of
tape marks,
you know?
Yeah.
So they laid out this course there, and we would meet on, you know, meet there on the weekends and play 18 holes. It was a pretty cool course, but it ran right through this area of the park. It was highly trafficked, and you know, you'd have to
that can wait. Cause problems.
Sometimes you had to wait on the tee for like, you know, 4 or 5 minutes while the, you know, all the bikers and the walkers,
dog walkers,
through. Yeah. So people started saying, well, we need a course. We need a disc golf course there, you know, and we'd seen baskets, we'd played on them, and it was a society. In fact, it was called the Pittsburgh Flying Disc Society that sort of said, yeah, we need a course. We know there's other courses in Pennsylvania and other places. A couple of people, Marcus Wittich, Henry Thorne, and Steve Komen put together a proposal, pitched it to the city of Pittsburgh, their parks department. And they kind of considered it for a while, and then we didn't hear much, nothing really happening. We kept playing the object course at Schenley Park. And then sort of what seemed like out of the blue, we heard back from the city, and they say, yeah, we just got a grant from the Hunt Foundation to buy a disc golf course. We want to do it, and we want to do it in Schenley Park. But we want to do it in a different part of Schenley Park. So they, you know, they showed us the area. The object course was at Flagstaff Hill, and the area they wanted to do it was at the Overlook. It wasn't far from it, but you know, it looked like a great location. They
9 hole or 18?
It was an 18 hole course.
Okay.
And at that time we were throwing, you know, the Whammo, these Midnight Flyers. And then, you know, Innova, this was probably 83, 84, Innova just come out with the Eagle, the bevel edged disc, and we were throwing, I won't say obsolete plastic, but let's call it, I don't know what to call it, legacy plastic, or and so the course was designed with that in mind, and it's the course is still there, pretty much in the same configuration as Steve Komen designed it. but it's so short, you know, like the holes, the longest hole is about 390, I think.
And are there baskets there?
They're baskets. Yeah. They were originally two baskets.
Okay.
But we asked the city to upgrade them, which they did. The course went in 1988. We put in some concrete tee pads in 1998. And we asked them to upgrade the course to new baskets in 2008. It's pretty much been that since then.
goal@gmail.com for the sport by presenting fellow disc golfers who have inspirational stories. If you or someone you know would like to be on the show, send an email to rockfishproductions@gmail.com. Or you can contact me through the show's Facebook page or Instagram and Twitter accounts. Check them out. And if you're so inclined, drop me a line or provide some feedback. I'd appreciate it. If you'd like to contribute to Breaking Chains, simply go to the show site, www.rockfishproductions.com, and click on the red button at the bottom of the page. This episode's guest is J. Gary Dropchow. In the episode's second half, we continue to talk about Pittsburgh's Schenley Park, having fun with Red Whittington, learning from better players, and moving from the amateur to the pro ranks. This is Breaking Chains. Is the course heavily used?
Very heavily used. It's the most popular course. It's, in fact, on UDisc, it is the most popular course in Pennsylvania. It gets the most, UDisc rated rounds, amazingly, even though it's not the first or the oldest or the best course. It's definitely not the best course, but
it's beginner friendly.
It's beginner friendly. There's Pitt and CMU are right there. It's a great introduction to the game. Red Whittington, who has won 2 PGA World Championships as a master and a grandmaster, said that's why, because he learned how to putt on a basket. He had a basket he could go to every day and putt. And, you know, he learned the strategy of the game, and he toured extensively. I mean, he went all over the country playing tournaments. That's why he got really good. But he credits his ability to putt for Schenley Park getting the baskets.
Well, J. Gary, I was going to save this question for later, but you're almost forcing me to ask it now. I need to ask you about a certain dialect that you would occasionally adopt when you were on road trips with Red Whittington.
Okay.
Apparently, you are Jed and Red, and I'm supposed to say it like that.
It is Jed. I am Jed, and he is Red. And there was other people in the group, too. There was Stead, and there was Ked. And there was also Ed and Ellie May. And it got to be a thing. It's Yinzer. It's Yinzer talk. And so we would on the course, we'd be talking in funny ways, like, oh, we need to red this course up. It's all muddy and slippy. And we'd talk, and we just, you know, just thought stupid talk. But where it really broke out was when we would travel to Toronto, and we played tournaments there on Toronto Island. And we'd hang out with Elaine King and Eric Vandenberg, and we'd stay with them. And we would do these, you know, talk these routines, and they would sort of start to talk that way too, even though they were Canadian, and we would sometimes imitate their dialect.
This course goes in and you start playing. How did you learn how to get better? Because, you know, you're at the forefront of the sport, and this is a long time before YouTube. Yeah. What did you do?
I watched Steve and Red, and, played against them, and got beat by them most all the time, and just watching other players. At some of these tournaments we would travel to, I remember one of those tournaments in Louisville. I think it was one of those disc derbies in Louisville. I grew up with David Greenwell. I just watched him, you know, just watched how he gripped the disc, like curled his wrist on the backswing, and how he turned his shoulders, turned his hips, and, you know, just kind of watch that and watch how they putted, and tried to learn from that. And the first person I ever saw putt, kind of, it really impressed me, was H.B. Clark. Now there was a, even before Shenley went in, Steve Komen ran a PDGA tournament. The first PDGA tournament in Pittsburgh was in 1984. And Steve got Eric Knudsen from Virginia, from the Washington Area Frisbee Club, I think it was, to bring a trailer load of portable pole holes to Pittsburgh to set up on a course that Steve designed in Frick Park. And it was actually a cool place. It was where we hoped that the city would put the permanent course that they eventually put in Shenley Park. But we thought it was great because there was a 9-hole ball golf course on part of this area, and just was like beautiful looking fairways. This was my first PDGA tournament. Actually, it's when I joined the PDGA at this tournament. And H.B. Clark, K.B. Clark's younger brother, came up to Pittsburgh to play in this tournament. H.B. sort of a straddle putter, and he had this sort of nose down straddle putt that he would throw it, and it was sort of a lobbing, you know, that sort of had it dropped as he putted it. Mm-hmm. He putted high and it dropped into the basket. I watched him straddle putt like this and just hitting the chains. So I started doing that. I started straddle putting immediately, and I, for what reason, I don't know, but it worked. And, you know, I just kind of, that's my natural putt. I'm a natural straddle putter. It took me a long time to really develop a stagger stance putt that I am as confident in as that.
I think that's the element of the game that all new players struggle with, and it's the type of putt they're going to use. You know, anybody can go up and drive, you know, throw it pretty far. I think after a couple rounds, you know, you sort of get that rhythm. But I think it's the putting. You know, do you use a spin? Do you use a push? You know, how do you stand? But I guess, you know, you had great guys around you, and you could imitate them, and it worked out.
Yeah, and you know, it's the maxim is the adage is true: you drive for show and you putt for dough.
Oh yeah.
I was giving a putting lesson this morning, actually, and a brand new player who's obviously athletic and coordinated and wants to learn, and kind of took him through what has taken me 30 some years to really understand and learn. And in my real job, I guess I would say it, for 25 years, I was a high school English teacher in Pittsburgh public schools. So I've learned, not only have I learned how to throw frisbees, but I've also learned how to teach. So it's one of the things that I've really enjoyed as much as designing disc golf courses and playing disc golf myself, but teaching other people how to play it's a lot of fun, and it's very rewarding to see other people say, oh, okay, yeah, that's right. I can do that. That worked. I like that a lot. And so that's kind of, you know, where I'm at right now. I know we've been talking about, you know, where I was and how I got here, but.
And how soon did you turn from amateur to pro status?
So 89, that's when I won the first PDGA amateur national championship.
Okay.
It was the first PDGA major for amateurs.
And where was that held?
It was held at Laurel Springs at Boylan Family Farm. And this course is no longer there, but it is legendary because it was, in many ways, sort of the next generation, the big leap in course design that required throwing, a distance drive to a place, to an area where you could then throw a second shot to approach the basket from.
Right.
It had par four holes on it. There were par three holes on it as well. It was on a Christmas tree farm in the Blue Ridge Mountains and of Virginia. No, I'm sorry, of North Carolina. And there's a little crossroads there on the Blue Ridge Parkway called Laurel Springs, and it was close to that. But it was a private course that this man, Bill Boylan, had heard about disc golf and thought he would be cool if he had people come to his place and play disc golf. And so he bought a course, and he designed this layout, which is incredible because he really hadn't played disc golf much himself. He had some help from some North Carolina people, from Carlton Howard. I know Stan McDaniel was there, Steve Lambert, as well from North Carolina, that went there and sort of helped, gave him some ideas and suggestions about, you know, ways to route the holes. And it was nicely done. It had two 9-hole loops that started at the top of the hill, right by where his house was on this estate, like, but it played down these hills and across these ravines into these fields of Christmas trees, some of which were just saplings, but they were laid out like, in rows. Mm-hmm. And the first hole, you can find pictures of this, I'm sure, if you Google Laurel Springs or Boylan Family Farms. The first hole, you teed off from up right by the porch on the hole on Boylan's house, and you threw across this ravine, and it was probably 400 feet. It was mostly downhill, but you threw to this area, this other hillside across the ravine to this hillside that faced you, and there were these two paths, and they're like farm roads basically, that intersected right where the basket was placed. And then on the four corners from that cross were these rows of Christmas tree seedlings. So it was just beautiful, picturesque framed basket that you got to throw, downhill in the mountain air and just watch them fly. Anyway, so that's where the Steve Lambert and Rick Rothstein organized. Actually, Rick Rothstein organized it. Steve Lambert was his assistant. Organized the first amateur national championship. Bill had a couple pro events there called Super Tour events. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be the highest level of sanctioned PDJ pro events there in the years before that. And at the time, the PDJ was certainly growing, but the growing pain was, well, what do we do with these amateur players? These people that, they're not really pros. They're not good enough to compete, but they're playing. There's many of them out at our courses. We need to figure out a way to, grow the sport by including these people as well. And even though it was the Professional Disc Golf Association, they formed the advanced division. And it was really 89 was the first year for it. Actually, at this tournament, there was sort of a round table or a meeting with people to talk about what is an amateur. And the PDJ was working out a lot of these details about how to classify this level of play and should they accept money or not. While this was getting worked out, there were it was called a Pro 2 category where, as you were amateur, but you could play for money if you were, good enough. And it was a little nebulous. But
that's odd.
it was really odd. It was strange. And so the PDJ came out with a declaration of what an amateur was. And that was, you could not accept cash at a tournament.
Okay.
If you accepted cash, you were no longer an amateur. In 1989, Pittsburgh was hosting, we were starting to host tournaments at Fenway Park. And it was part of a Can-Am series, a series of tournaments that were held in the Great Lakes region. Including Canada and Michigan and Ohio and New York and Pennsylvania. And so we were holding a tournament here in Pittsburgh. It was at Fenway Park. This is spring of 1989. The PDJ just issued these classification guidelines. So I played advanced in I think it was the Pittsburgh Flying Disc Open at this tournament at Fenway Park. And I won the division. I won the event. As an advanced player, the field might have been 10 players. I'm not even sure how big it was. And it was pretty cool. I won. So the awards ceremony, the tournament directors hand out the awards and they go through the advanced, division. And he's handing out cash to the advanced players, which was legal. I mean, it was totally legal, but I had to decide if I was going to accept the cash or not. But I knew about this amateur national championship in North Carolina later that year. And I decided I was going to play in it. I just thought that, I want to go there. That sounds like a cool place to play. I'm going to play in it. So I turned down the cash. I kept my amateur status there, and I played some other tournaments during the during that year leading up to it as an amateur. And so we went to Laurel Springs and played the event there. It was four rounds, a 3-day tournament. The first day we everybody played one round of 18 holes on the course. It was a shotgun start. The second day there were two rounds, and the third day there was a final round. So there were like about 3 weeks before the event, before we left, I was doing some work at the course at Chinle Park, doing some cleanup, moving branches or carrying logs or something. And I hurt my hand. I just like something in the back of my hand, just a tendon, just kind of snapped or something. Just like, you know, I couldn't play disc golf. So I knew, I was like thinking, oh my God, here we go again. You know, I'm getting hurt before I play these tournament. This is my pattern or whatnot. So I just had to keep playing. So I started playing left-handed. And, it was crazy. I wouldn't say I'm ambidextrous, but I'm kind of coordinated. So I was able to figure out how to throw the disc left-handed and could get it to, you know, flex, and I could turn it over. We're throwing Stingrays, XDs, and there was like the classic rock. I was putting with an 86 softy, a whammo golf disc. So I'm playing left-handed, and I'm getting my goal was like, okay, well, I have no idea what's going to happen with the tournament. Maybe I'm not going to be able to go. I don't know. Maybe I'll have to play left-handed. I'm practicing left-handed, and I actually shot par, which was 54 at Chinle Park, one round. Now, Red and Steve are shooting like 10, 15 under, but for me, that was pretty cool. I was like a goal that I thought I was going to, you know, I was trying for, and I made that. The tournament comes around, and I'm still not even sure. I haven't even thrown a disc right-handed. I'm not sure what's going to happen, but I'm entered and I'm going. And if I have to play left-handed, I'm going to. So my wife and I traveled, and we traveled down with a couple other Pittsburgh players. Lynn Giroux was a female player, and her husband, Michael Novara. And they both competed in the tournament too and had a great time. So we get there, and I said, well, I got to test it. So in the practice round, I started playing. You know, I threw a shot right-handed, and it didn't hurt. I was amazed.
But now you have left and right.
I couldn't even throw three quarters of the distance left-handed, and my putting was just, you know, crazy, shaky. So I thought, oh, wow, I'm going to be able to play, and I was, you know, I was ecstatic, just thrilled. And one of the holes, I think it was the ninth hole. There, you play up this hill, up the fairway, and then the hole makes this dog leg left into this apple orchard. And so we were practicing the hole, and I don't know, you know, just I was so happy, and I reached up. We're walking past this apple tree, and I just reached up with my right hand, and I grabbed an apple or a branch or something and pulled it, but the branch sort of sliced my finger.
Oh my gosh.
My index finger, right? And I'm thinking, geez, what? How stupid! What's wrong with you? Why can't you not hurt yourself? So I put some tape on it, and it wasn't a bad cut, but it was enough that I had to cover it. But what was really cool about this, and I don't know why all these things came together, but the tape on my finger made me very conscious about gripping the disc with my index finger around the rim, which is what I should do to make, you know, get a full power throw. But it was just a little trigger that made me remember that, so that, you know, I would grip the disc firmly, I guess is what it was. And I was just throwing great. I was throwing awesome. It was amazing. I didn't know what to
expect. Hey, with all these injuries, Jay Garry, you deserve this, okay?
I didn't know what to expect in the tournament. I didn't know who was there. You know, I didn't know the quality of the players or anybody. I don't think I knew any of the players, but I won. You know, I won this national championship, and you know, I don't know what came over me. It was just maybe it was, you know, a lot of things coming together, but it was a great experience. The tournament was great. The players were awesome. Everybody was having fun. The host, Bill Boylan, and his family hosted us, and you know, there was a picnic, there was dinners, and it was just beautiful setting. My wife was there with me, that, you know, that was fun too. Yeah,
it was perfect. It was moment.
A great experience.
Just a perfect moment.
It was great. Yeah. For winning the tournament, the PDGA gave me an invitation to play in Pro Worlds that year. It was going to be in Iowa. I said, yeah, sure. Let's go. I played the tournament there. I kind of traveled out with Steve Komen and Red Whittington. We flew out and, you know, rented a car, had a great time, you know, just amazing. The tournament, let's see, I guess was won by Steve Wisecup. Is that correct? I didn't make the cut for the semis. I ended up being a spectator and really was awed by how these players were throwing and putting and all of that. But in the parking lot after this, I think it was after the semifinal round, and Ken Klemo's in the parking lot and he's really upset. What's wrong? And he said, oh man, I just played so bad. I know I should have done better. And then he was just berating himself. And I said, well, what happened? What did you shoot? And he said, I shot 10 down. I thought, okay.
Are you still playing actively?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I've been playing since then and still playing. Been playing more Grandmasters and Masters event. I'll play, you know, MPO, you know, local tournaments, D-tiers and that kind of thing.
That wraps up part one of my interview with J. Gary Dropcho. Part two will be available on Friday, July 3rd. You can find out more about J. Gary on the show's website, www.rockfishproductions.com. Kevin MacLeod wrote and performed the show's theme, Unwritten Return. The music at the break, Flying Away, was written and performed by DP Music. This podcast is copyrighted by Rockfish Productions, LLC.